It's been a busy week for the Federal Reserve, working hard to provide help to markets shaken by the credit crunch. The central bank helped arrange a deal late Sunday for the investment bank J.P. Morgan to purchase the ailing firm Bear Stearns. And just a little while ago, the Fed cut a key interest rate 0.75 percentage point. With the Federal Reserve popping up in economic headlines almost every day, we thought it was time to go back to the basics. Just how does the Fed work? What are its limits and what can it do? We're taking your questions about the Federal Reserve. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. Send an email to talk@npr.org or comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And joining us now in Studio 3A is Vincent Reinhardt, a former director of the Federal Reserve Board's Division of Monetary Affairs. He's currently a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Vincent, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is the Federal Reserve intended to do? What's it there for?
Okay, it's your nation's central bank. And according to the enabling legislation, the Federal Reserve, in conducting monetary policy, is supposed to foster maximum employment and stable prices.
Now, explain its relationship to the government. It's independent.
Right.
What does that mean exactly? And yet it's also appointed by the administration, correct?
Right. So it's a unique creature that has both a public and a private sector element. It could go all the way back to 1913 when they were talking about the legislation. There were two strands in American political tradition. There were populists and there were internationalists. Populists hated banks to begin with and distrusted central authority. Internationalists wanted somebody who could sit at the table with counterparts from the Bank of England or the Bank of France. And this being the United States, you had a political compromise in which they got both. There are 12 reserve banks spread across the entire nation. That's the local representation. And there is a central authority, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, that has 7 members here in Washington, D.C. Those people are appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. The heads of the 12 reserve banks are private citizens.
Now, does all the money come from taxpayer funds? Or?
So the Federal Reserve is independent in a number of ways. One is it's off the federal budget. The Federal Reserve has a great business. They issue little pieces of green paper that is currency that pays no interest, and they get that into the banking system by buying interest-earning treasury securities. So they've got a balance sheet that's about $900 billion big. On the one side, the assets it holds are mostly U.S. treasury securities earning interest. The liabilities are mostly currency. That currency is, by the way, about two-thirds held by foreigners just because it represents a safe asset. Now, that means the Federal Reserve earned last year about $35 billion in that interest income, met his expenses, then reimbursed everything to the Treasury.
Now, in the case of when you hear that the Fed bailed out Bear Stearns to the tune of $30 billion, or is going to make $30 billion worth of, you know, credit line available, where does that money come from?
So a central bank makes it itself. And because people are confident in the value of the currency, the Federal Reserve can create money. That's what a central bank does. And actually what the Federal Reserve did is a number of new initiatives over the last week, basically trying to solve a fundamental problem we have right now. A lot of large, complex financial institutions hold assets on their balance sheet that can't trade, mortgage-related securities. And the Federal Reserve is trying to figure out ways to free up that space on their balance sheet by essentially exposing its own balance sheet to that risk.
All right. We are taking your calls. We're doing a primer here on the Fed, and I think we have a couple of questions here. Let's go to Troy in Iowa City. Troy, are you there?
Yes, I am. I got a couple questions. Number one, is the Federal Reserve part of the United States government? What I understand, it is not part of the government. Number two, I think the Federal Reserve bailed up Bear Stearns is because of derivatives of a tune of $750 trillion worth of derivatives. And the last part is the British were searching and seizing guns. That's why we do not have there's a constitutional law on search and seizure. They were seizing guns.
Okay, I think that refers to our last part of the show, but let's take the questions on the Fed.
I'll answer the two questions. The Federal Reserve is an independent federal agency. That is, the Federal Reserve Board is part of the government. The 12 reserve banks are technically private institutions, and so they're outside of the government. So the Federal Reserve as a whole is inside and outside the government. Now, with regard to the role of derivatives, a reason the Federal Reserve acted in facilitating the resolution of Bear Stearns was exactly concerns about derivatives. It's got a big balance sheet. It's got lots of obligations. They may net to a small number, but there's a large gross exposure. And there's just an open question. If the firm failed, would there be a cascading wave of failures as people expecting payment didn't get it?
All right. Let's see if we can get another call in here now. Hi, we're going to Steve in San Antonio. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are y'all?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to question the existence of a central bank. If people remember their history, we as a country have had two separate central banks before. The First Bank of the United States, and I can't remember what the second one was called, possibly the Second Bank of the United States. Thomas Jefferson took out the first one. Andrew Jackson took out the second one. The problem is, and the founders of this country knew this, when they put in the Constitution that all gold or all dollars should be minted and coined by the government, that meant that Congress should have control over it. Unfortunately, with the Federal Reserve System, you have little to no Congress control over the operations of the Federal Reserve, which is a private central bank owned by private bankers who are acting in their own interests. When they're printing money, they drive up the devaluation of the currency to where right now, I mean, you have the U.S. dollar at a higher inflation rate than the Mexican peso. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Let's see if our guest can respond to some of your points here, Steve.
So in fact, the Federal Reserve is the third triad of central bank in the United States. It was the first bank in the United States, and it was, imaginatively enough, the second bank of the United States. Both of them were not rechartered. The Federal Reserve is in and out of the government. That is, the Board of Governors is a government agency. Those are government employees, presidential appointees, and confirmed by the Senate. That is the seven governors. The reserve banks technically are private, but all major decisions in terms of employment are subject to a veto by the Board of Governors. So it is within the government. I think the key issue is the Federal Reserve is quasi-independent because politicians recognize a central bank should be somewhat independent. Why? Because you go to the central bank to make hard decisions, that is, worry about price stability in the long run. The short-run temptation is to deliver an easier monetary policy that ultimately produces inflation. Politicians don't want to have to make that hard decision, so they put the responsibility to an independent central bank.
Here's an interesting question from Bryce in Salt Lake City, Utah. Why was the Fed unable to stabilize the crash of 1929? And I guess inherent in that question is the question, will they be able to stabilize our current economic situation?
You can actually make an argument that this is our fourth attempt. That there were four attempts at central banks in the United States. In 1929, the Federal Reserve made a series of mistakes. They looked at the level of the nominal money market rate and then interpret that as saying something about the stance of policy. What they weren't recognizing is that deflation was spreading through the whole country. Then they didn't act to expand its balance sheet and allowed a large number of depository institutions to fail. The failures of those institutions meant that measures of liquidity, the monetary aggregate, shrank by about a third over the next couple years. Congress, recognizing that problem, made some changes.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today. Vincent Reinhardt is a former director at the Federal Reserve Board and is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He joined us from Studio 3A in Washington. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. It's Tuesday, the day we read from your emails and blog comments. It was quite a week on Talk of the Nation. We covered the Spitzer scandal, the presidential campaign, the military, and we also took some time to look at magicians, the role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons, and time travel. Due to some unforeseen technical difficulties, one of our guests' time machines didn't quite work. Author Zizi Packer wasn't able to join as we'd planned, so we've taken a little time today to hear her time travel wishes. She's the author of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, and last year she was named one of America's best young novelists by Grantham Magazine. She joins us now from her office in San Jose, California. Welcome to the program, Zizi.
Hi, Lynn. It's great to be here.
So what time and place would you like to travel to?
Well, I would like to travel to the future. I know a lot of the guests said in the past that they wanted to travel to the past, to particular battlefields, and to solve certain rabbinical problems and those sorts of things. But I would like to travel to the future probably 100 or maybe 150 years into the future, but not any more than that. And the place I would like to go to is not a definite place, but wherever there would be a family reunion of my descendants. And I just think that we don't get a chance to see we may get a chance to see what our kids turn out to be and even our grandkids. But, you know, beyond that, we just don't see. We don't see if there's a president or a physicist or whoever that's in our sort of, that eventually comes, you know, that in the end comes from us. And it would just be great to witness, you know, the, you know, 50 or 100 or more descendants and what they're up to.
Now, what would you like to see them doing? Or do you have any ideas of where you'd like them to be in life?
Yeah, well, obviously everyone wants your descendants to be successful and to have done more in life than you yourself did, and so that's always the goal. But also just in terms of to see them, I mean, you know, the sort of physically what they look like, that, you know, in terms of, you know, did you end up, you know, did someone end up marrying, you know, teachers, or did you, you know, if you're black, did your family end up in white or Chinese or so, you know, just in 150 years, almost anything can kind of happen, and you can see this sort of whole panoply of people, you know, and I kind of just think about Barack Obama having all of this, you know, this family scattered all over the earth, and that would just be a really glorious thing to see them all in one place, talking to one another, exchanging what they're doing, and just seeing technologically what's happened by way of that, because so many of the advances have occurred in the last 100 years of our lifetime, you know, planes and trains and, you know, the space shuttle and, you know, the internet. And so in another 100 years, I imagine that they would just be conducting their regular lives, and we would, meaning me and, you know, people who are on Earth now, would just be amazed by what they could do. Maybe they could time travel. Maybe they could live on the moon. You'd have a family reunion on the moon or Mars or something like that. But that would just be an incredible thing to see.
Well, maybe that'll happen someday.
I hope.
Zizi Packer is the author of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, a collection of 8 stories. Last year, she was named one of America's best young novelists by Grantham Magazine. She joined us from her office in San Jose, California. Thanks so much, Zizi. It was fun talking with you.
It was great talking with you, Lynn.
And moving on to fantasies of another stripe entirely, we received this letter from a listener who didn't like the affectionate use of the word geeks to describe Dungeons & Dragons players. Listening to our appreciation of the late Gary Gygax, Ted in Fort Lauderdale wrote, "I questioned the use of the term geek. First, not all D&D players were geeks in the currently accepted sense of asocial computer experts, sci-fi fans, etc. Second is the term itself. While some of the various geek communities use the term ourselves, its use seems condescending. In the mundane world, the term geek still has many connotations of loser. After all, the original geeks were carnival performers who bit the heads off live chickens. Perhaps gaming fans would have been a less judgmental, if less catchy, term. However, we did receive some mail from proud geeks as well. Deja in Jamestown wrote, "Thank you for the look into D&D and Gary Gygax's influence. I was glad to hear another female player. There are more than when I started playing, but still not a lot. I started playing in the early 80s when my mother taught me. My husband and I bonded over our weekly games in high school, and we still play every week on Mondays. And our daughter is starting to play as well. Yep, 3 generations of geeks and proud of it. We welcome letters from everyone, geeks, nerds, and all. And if you want to go back and listen to the show, you can find our podcasts by going to npr.org/talk. And if you have comments, questions, or corrections for us, The best way to reach us is by email. Our address is talk@npr.org. Please let us know where you're writing from and give us some help on how to pronounce your name. Talk of the Nation is produced by Susan Lund, Susanna George, David Gura, Enrique Rivera, Ashley Grayshaw, Dahlia Martinez, and Addie Wizenot. Our editor is Barry Hardiman. Beth Novi produces our web content. Our intern is Amanda Stupheim. Gwen Uten directs the program. Our assistant producer is Sarah Handel. Drew Reynolds is our technical director. He gets engineering help from Dennis Nielsen. Talk of the Nation's senior producer is Scott Cameron. Sue Goodwin is the executive producer. Richard L. Harris is NPR's director of afternoon programming. Tomorrow, Neil Conan will be back for another edition of The Political Junkie. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington.